Chapter 31 Verse 1 Now he heard the things that Laban's sons were saying. Jacob has taken all that was our father's, and from that which was our father's, he has built up all this wealth. When they saw Jacob became rich, Laban's sons viewed Jacob's wealth as essentially stolen, despite the fact that A. Laban asked Jacob to name a price for his many years of service, and B. that service resulted in great prosperity for Laban. Laban had agreed to Jacob's request for the relatively rare speckled animals as payment, and even then, Laban tried to limit Jacob's share by hiding the speckled and spotted animals and entrusting them to his sons. Genesis chapter 30, verses 35 through 36, who presumably knew of their father's ploy to rob Jacob. Yet these sons were now accusing Jacob of cheating their father. Jacob's wealth, therefore, was entirely due to his own efforts and God's blessing. Laban's sons were among the many throughout history who resent the success of others rather than seek to emulate it. Recall the Philistines' reaction to Isaac's wealth in Genesis chapter 26, verse 15. And who believe people become rich only by taking wealth from others? See commentary to Genesis chapter 26, verses 13 through 15. The subject of envy comes up often in Genesis because Genesis is about the human condition, and envy is all too human, as is exaggeration and arguing dishonestly. Laban's son said, "Jacob has taken all that was our father's." When people do not have facts on their side, they often resort to inaccuracy and outright distortion. As a well-known lawyer's adage puts it, if you have the law on your side, argue the law. If you have the facts, argue the facts. If you have neither, pound the table. Verse 2. Jacob also saw that Laban's manner toward him was not as it had been in the past. Laban's attitude toward Jacob had never been one of respect. See, for example, Genesis chapter 29, verse 19. That is why he was sure he could get away with tricking him regarding Leah and Rachel. However, Laban's attitude toward Jacob has now deteriorated. Perhaps it derived from Laban's subconscious guilt over taking advantage of Jacob. Perhaps it came from the grumbling of his sons. Whatever the reason, relations were deteriorating between them, and Jacob needed to do something. Verse 3. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers where you were born, and I will be with you." Jacob already knew it was time to leave, and had sought Laban's blessing, Genesis chapter 30, verse 26, only to have Laban throw another delaying tactic in his path, Genesis chapter 30, verses 27 through 28. But now, God himself confirmed it was time for him to depart Laban's household and return to the promised land. Verse 4. Jacob had Rachel and Leah called to the field where his flock was. It was time to make the case for leaving to his wives. Rachel, though younger and the second wife, is mentioned first because she was Jacob's beloved wife. To this day, more than 3,000 years later, when Jews mention the names of the patriarchs and matriarchs, they are all mentioned in chronological order except for Rachel and Leah. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Though this might seem unfair to Leah, it reflects subtle disapproval of Leah for having deceived Jacob into marrying her. Verse 5, and said to them, "I see that your father's manner toward me is not as it has been in the past, but the God of my father has been with me." Jacob spoke of God as a family or clan deity, terms he knew Rachel and Leah would readily understand. These women had grown up in a polytheistic world with a polytheistic father. Even after their many years with Jacob, it is unlikely they had become fully accustomed to the concept of a single and universal God. Wide acceptance of monotheism, even among the Hebrews Israelites, let alone among non-Hebrews, was a very gradual process. Verse 6. As you know, I have served your father with all my might. Verse 7. But your father has cheated me, changing my wages time and again. God, however, would not let him do me harm. Because he had a greater historical purpose for Jacob, God made an exception to the general rule of divine non-intervention in human affairs, and saw to it that Jacob did not suffer the consequences of Laban's injustices. Verse 8, if he said thus, "The speckled shall be your wages," then all the flocks would drop speckled young. And if he said thus, "The streaked shall be your wages," then all the flocks would drop streaked young. Verse 9. God has taken away your father's livestock and given it to me. By this, Jacob did not mean what Laban's sons meant when they grumbled about Jacob getting wealthy by taking away what had belonged to their father. Jacob began his own flock with only a very few animals, the spotted and speckled specimens that Laban hadn't been able to hide from him. But thereafter, far greater numbers of the flock than would ordinarily be expected to gave birth to speckled and spotted young, greatly increasing Jacob's livestock. Verse 10, once at the mating time of the flocks, I had a dream in which I saw that the he-goats mating with the flock were streaked, speckled, and mottled. Verse 11, and in the dream an angel of God said to me, Jacob. Here, I answered. Verse 12, and he said, note well that all the he-goats which are mating with the flock are streaked, speckled, and mottled, for I have noted all that Laban has been doing to you. In the course of explaining to his wives that he had not cheated their father, Jacob attributed to God how greater than normal offspring were born to the flock, designated to him by his agreement with Laban, not to the rods he used to manipulate the color of the flocks. Verse 13, I am the God of Bethel, where you appointed a pillar and where you made a vow to me. Bethel was the name of the place where Jacob placed a rock under his head and dreamt of the stairway to heaven. The God of the whole world was not here identifying himself as the God of Bethel and nowhere else. He was merely reminding Jacob of their encounter at Bethel many years before and of their mutual vows. God vowed to provide Jacob protection, and Jacob vowed that if God followed through on that promise and brought him safely back to the land of his birth, God would be his God and he would tithe his wealth. Genesis chapter 28, verses 15 through 22. Verse 13 continued, now arise and leave this land and return to your native land. Verse 14. Then Rachel and Leah answered him, saying, have we still a share in the inheritance of our father's house? Verse 15. Surely he regards us as outsiders, now that he has sold us and has used up our purchase price. Verse 16. Truly, all the wealth that God has taken away from our father belongs to us and to our children. Now then, do just as God has told you. Alter explains the daughter's lament. Laban has evidently pocketed all of the fruits of Jacob's 14 years of labor. His daughters thus see themselves reduced to chattel by their father, not married off, but rather sold for profit, as though they were not his flesh and blood. Verse 17. Thereupon Jacob put his children and wives on camels. Verse 18. And he drove off all his livestock and all the wealth that he had amassed, the livestock in his possession that he had acquired in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Belief in idols and belief in God. Verse 19. Meanwhile, Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel stole her father's household idols. Rashi theorized that Rachel stole the idols in an attempt to wean her father away from idol worship. But if she stole the idols to wean her father away from idol worship, Abraham Ibn Ezra, a 12th century Spanish Jewish biblical commentator, asks, why would she take them with her when she could have hidden them by, for example, burying them? More likely, she stole them because she believed they would bring good fortune on the journey back to Jacob's homeland. Various modern commentators have offered another explanation. In keeping with ancient Near Eastern beliefs, Rachel sought thereby to declare Jacob, not Laban, head of their household. These theories notwithstanding, there is a simpler explanation. Rachel surely believed in the God of Jacob, but she might well have still believed in the power of the idols with which she grew up. Throughout history, many people around the world combined traditional pagan beliefs with belief in the God of the Bible, a fusion of religious beliefs known as syncretism. When people believe in many visible gods, it takes a very long time to get them to believe in one invisible God. Rachel's behavior may have been similar to that of Niels Bohr, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist who was said to keep a rabbit's foot in his laboratory. When an astonished visitor asked, "But surely, Professor, you don't believe in a rabbit's foot?" Bohr responded, "Of course not. But they say a rabbit's foot brings you luck, whether you believe in it or not." Rachel, who was desperately anxious to have a child, Genesis chapter 30, verse 1, and then desperately anxious to have a second child, might well have been open to utilizing all means toward procuring her goal, including mandrakes and, of course, Jacob's God, but perhaps also gods from her father's household. Whatever was in Rachel's mind, the Bible makes clear it was only when God remembered Rachel, Genesis chapter 30, verse 22, that she conceived. Verse 20. Jacob kept Laban the Aramean in the dark, not telling him that he was fleeing. Verse 21, and fled with all that he had. Soon he was across the Euphrates and heading toward the hill country of Gilead. Verse 22, on the third day, Laban was told that Jacob had fled. Verse 23, so he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days, catching up with him in the hill country of Gilead. Verse 24, but God appeared to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, "Beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad." God told Laban to leave Jacob alone. A person as sly and selfish as Laban could not be trusted, even when he believes his motives are good. Verse 25. Laban overtook Jacob. Jacob had pitched his tent on the height, and Laban with his kinsmen encamped in the hill country of Gilead. Verse 26. And Laban said to Jacob, "What did you mean by keeping me in the dark and carrying off my daughters like captives of the sword?" Laban's accusation was disingenuous. As we know from verses 14 through 16, Rachel and Leah hardly regarded themselves as captives. They were fully supportive of Jacob's decision to leave. And as Jacob's wives, Jacob had every right to move away and take his family and belongings with him. Alter notes the word Laban used, nahag, translated here and elsewhere as carrying off, is usually reserved for animals, as in driving animals. See verse 18, he drove, nahag, his livestock. Essay on lying. Verse 27. Why did you flee in secrecy and mislead me and not tell me? I would have sent you off with festive music, with timbrel and lyre. Laban lied, claiming he would have given Jacob so gracious a send-off. Jacob knew Laban was lying, but did Laban know? Laban's statement to Jacob raises an intriguing question. Do liars believe their lies? Did Laban, when he made that claim, really believe he would have sent Jacob and his family off with festive music? The text does not answer this question, and readers are left to reach their own conclusion. Analyzing lies and liars is not merely intriguing, it is morally significant. Let us begin with people who do not know they are telling an untruth. The most obvious example, when a person says something that is mistaken, is not a lie, it is an error. For a false statement to be a lie, the person making the false statement must know it's false. So let us focus on the individual who is not simply making an occasional mistake, but who habitually lies. For such people, lying can become so natural they believe it themselves. They have actually convinced themselves they are not lying. According to a study conducted by a professor of cognitive neuroscience at University College London, people who tell small, self-serving lies are likely to progress to bigger falsehoods, and over time, the brain appears to adapt to the dishonesty. The brain adapting to dishonesty is another way of saying the individual no longer regards the lies he or she is telling as lies. It is therefore very difficult, if not impossible, for such people to change, because, having done nothing wrong in their own mind, they recognize no reason to repent, and therefore no reason to change. In the present context, it is quite possible Laban believed himself when he said, "I would have sent you off with festive music, with timbrel and lyre." Regarding such people, I will relate an anecdote. When I debated at the Oxford Union on the question of who posed the greater obstacle to peace, Israel or Hamas, one of my two opponents said, "Israel is doing to the Palestinians what the Nazis did to the Jews." This was as blatant a lie as one could tell. Did she believe it? The Nazis sought to murder every Jew in Europe, and they succeeded in murdering 6 million of them, 2 of every 3 Jews in Europe, within 4 years. These were not casualties of war. They were deliberate murders of non-combatants. The Nazi killing machine was organized and systematic. By contrast, including not only internal uprisings, but all of Israel's wars with its Arab neighbors, the 15,000 to 30,000 Palestinians killed since Israel's founding in 1948 were virtually all killed as a result of the numerous attempts, first by Arab armies and later by terrorist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah, to kill as many Israelis as possible and ultimately wipe Israel off the map. In the course of Israel's fraught relations with its Arab neighbors, there has been nothing remotely approximating the proportion, let alone the absolute number, of European Jews killed during World War II. And not only was there no Israeli policy of genocide, the opposite of genocide has taken place. During Israel's first 70 years, the population of Palestinians inside Israel increased sevenfold. Did my proponent at Oxford, who holds a doctorate in Middle East history, not know all this? Did she really believe millions of Palestinian men, women, children, and babies have been rounded up and sent to death camps? It is impossible to believe she did. But those who hate Israel have become so used to repeating lies about Israel, there was no voice in this woman, or in my other opponent, an anti-Israel Jewish professor, that asked, "Is this true?" Alternatively, and this is probably the case, she regarded undermining and even destroying Israel as so worthwhile a goal, it justified lying. So then, do people who lie on behalf of their cause know they are being dishonest? Some do, and some do not. The test comes when they are shown their supporting data is not accurate. Do they then stop making that argument? If they do, they are honest people who made an error, and errors are not lies. If they do not, they place ideology above truth. That, unfortunately, is not only common. It is probably the greatest source of mass evil in the world. This needs to be emphasized. Big lies have been the greatest source of modern evil, the genocides and mass murders of the 20th century. Vast numbers of Germans and other Europeans believed the lies told about Jews. Consequently, many Nazis believed that in murdering Jews, including babies and children, they were doing good. So, too, a vast number of people believed communist lies about class enemies and took part in the wholesale slaughter of men, women, and children in the Soviet Union, China, Cambodia, and elsewhere. That is why, whether the lie is small or large, infrequent or frequent, told by an individual or told by masses of people, every person must ask himself whenever making any claim, am I telling the truth? There is no more important question we can ask ourselves. Those who begin by justifying small lies, even just exaggerations, will, as the University College London study showed, end up telling bigger lies, and more often. But what about lying on behalf of a good cause? With few exceptions, that too leads to bad things. The most obvious exception is lying to save an innocent life. A non-Jew who lied to Nazis as to the whereabouts of Jews the Nazis sought to murder was not only morally right in lying, but morally obligated to do so. It is a perverse moral standard that holds lying to a Nazi about where Jews are hiding is more immoral than telling the truth, thereby enabling a Nazi to murder Jews. However, such circumstances are rare. One, therefore, has to be very careful about lying for a good cause. Rarely is so much at stake that lying becomes morally justifiable. A particularly powerful example took place at the beginning of World War I, when Allied propagandists made up stories of German atrocities to bolster the case for fighting Germany. It was right to fight the Germans, but most stories of German atrocities, German soldiers tossing infants in the air and impaling them on bayonets, cutting off children's hands, burning families alive, raping nuns, were lies. And when the war ended, that became known. As a result, during World War II, when accurate reports of German atrocities against Jews and others began to circulate, many in the West dismissed the reports, citing the false reports of World War I. Those who, with good motives, spread lies about German atrocities in World War I enabled many people 2 decades later to dismiss the true stories of German atrocities in World War II. Given the overwhelming importance of truth, it is no wonder the Talmud states, God's signature is truth. Verse 28. You did not even let me kiss my sons and daughters goodbye. It was a foolish thing for you to do. Laban employed an age-old tactic. The best defense is a good offense. Verse 29. I have it in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father said to me last night, beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad. Laban was clearly shaken by the appearance of Jacob's God in a vision the preceding night, warning him against harming Jacob. Laban did not worship this God, but he saw that Jacob had faith in him for good reason. He seemed to fear this God had the power to harm him. In the ancient world, pagans were tolerant of everyone else's gods, and even believed gods other than their own had powers. Only the Jews insisted there is only one God, and that he is the God of everyone. Verse 30. Very well, you had to leave because you were longing for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? Verse 31. Jacob answered Laban, saying, I was afraid because I thought you would take your daughters from me by force. This was Jacob's answer to Laban's first question, why did you flee in secrecy and mislead me and not tell me? Verse 27. Verse 32. But anyone with whom you find your gods shall not remain alive. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what I have of yours and take it. Jacob, of course, did not know that Rachel had stolen them. This is Jacob's answer to Laban's second question, "But why did you steal my gods?" Verse 30. Instead of simply assuring Laban that he did not take them, Jacob made an audacious pronouncement, one that must have terrified Rachel. We are all occasionally tempted to make these types of grandiose avowals, but they are risky and rarely necessary. Jacob's statement turned out to be highly risky and unnecessary, as it did not deter Laban from searching Jacob's and all the other tents. Verse 33. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and Leah's tent and the tents of the two maidservants, but he did not find them. Leaving Leah's tent, he entered Rachel's tent. Why didn't Laban believe Jacob's categorical denial that neither he nor anyone with him had stolen the idols? Because Laban regularly deceived people. People who lie assume everyone else does too. People who cheat in business, for example, assume everyone else cheats. It's part of how they justify what they do. If I don't, everyone else will take advantage of me. This is the built-in punishment of the dishonest. They go through life convinced they are constantly being deceived, or as George Bernard Shaw put it, the liar's punishment is not in the least that he is not believed, but that he cannot believe anyone else. Verse 34. Rachel, meanwhile, had taken the idols and placed them in the camel cushion and sat on them, and Laban rummaged through the tent without finding them. Verse 35. For she said to her father, "Let not my lord take it amiss that I cannot rise before you, for the period of women is upon me." Thus he searched, but could not find the household idols. Laban did not try to look under the cushion because menstruation was considered such an impurity. He was reluctant even to touch it. Furthermore, it would have been inconceivable to him that Rachel would run the risk of menstruating while sitting on his gods. Verse 36. Now Jacob became incensed. After 20 years of forbearance, Jacob finally lost his temper, and his pent-up grievances poured forth. Ironically, while Jacob's grievances against Laban were valid and Laban's were not, he exploded over the one complaint by Laban that had merit. Someone from Jacob's camp did steal Laban's idols. Verse 36 continued, and took up his grievance with Laban. Jacob spoke up and said to Laban, "What is my crime? What is my guilt that you should pursue me?" Verse 37, "You rummaged through all my things. What have you found of all your household objects? Set it here before my kinsmen and yours, and let them decide between us two." Jacob was incensed at being unjustly accused of both theft and lying after all his years of faithful service, despite Laban's mistreatment of him. Now the dam broke, and Jacob bared his soul. Verse 38. "These 20 years I have spent in your service. Your ewes and she-goats never miscarried, nor did I feast on rams from your flock." Verse 39. "That which was torn by beasts I never brought to you. I myself made good the loss. You exacted it of me, whether snatched by day or snatched by night." Verse 40. "Often scorching heat ravaged me by day and frost by night, and sleep fled from my eyes." Verse 41. "Of the 20 years that I spent in your household, I served you 14 years for your two daughters," only one of whom he wanted, Jacob could have added. Verse 41, continued, "and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wages time and again." Verse 42, "Had not the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac, been with me, you would have sent me away empty-handed. But God took notice of my plight and the toil of my hands, and he gave judgment last night." This is the real reason Jacob left without saying goodbye. He knew that Laban would have tried to prevent not only Jacob's family from leaving, but his livestock as well. God's judgment last night refers to God's revelation to Laban to do Jacob no harm. Verse 43. Then Laban spoke up and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks. All that you see is mine. Yet what can I do now about my daughters or the children they have borne?" And here is the proof. Laban viewed his daughters and grandchildren as his rightful possessions. To him, Jacob was nothing more than an indentured servant, entitled to his own freedom after his years of service expired, but not to his wives, children, or flocks. See commentary on chapter 30, verse 26. But he also understood how limited were his options. His daughters had free will, and they preferred to go with their husband, and he was facing the will of Jacob's God, who wanted Jacob left unharmed to return with his family to the promised land. Verse 44. "Come then, let us make a pact, you and I, that there may be a witness between you and me." Verse 45. Thereupon Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Verse 46. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a mound, and they partook of a meal there by the mound. Verse 47. Laban named it Yeger Sahadutha, but Jacob named it Gilad. Verse 48. And Laban declared, "This mound is a witness between you and me this day." That is why it was named Gilad. Gil means mound of rocks, Ad means witness. Verse 49. And it was called Mitzpah because he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are out of sight of each other." Verse 50. "If you ill-treat my daughters or take other wives besides my daughters, though no one else be about, remember, God himself will be witness between you and me." Though his daughters didn't seem to think their father had much interest in them at this point, surely he regards us as outsiders, verse 15, Laban revealed he was still a father who cared about his daughters. Few people, even among the indecent, do not have a special place in their heart for their children. Verse 51. And Laban said to Jacob, "Here is this mound, and here the pillar which I have set up between you and me." Verse 52. "This mound shall be witness, and this pillar shall be witness, that I am not to cross to you past this mound, and that you are not to cross to me past this mound and this pillar with hostile intent." Verse 53. "May the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, their ancestral deities, judge between us." And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Verse 54. Jacob then offered up a sacrifice on the height and invited his kinsmen to partake of the meal. After the meal, they spent the night on the height.